You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is the 10th of September, and this is Priya. I'm in the studio with Leela and Inez. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
It's a time, and I know that a lot of people in the community are feeling pretty heavy right now, and I just want to send all of our love out to folks. We're processing a lot, and we have a very full show today, and we might jump into what we've got in the rundown.
Yes, so first we listen back to a segment from Earth Matters, which aired on the 6th of September, where host Mia interviewed Dr. Kylie Soanes, who is a research fellow at the University of Melbourne, about her work finding innovative ways to encourage urban biodiversity. Now, Dr. Kylie is a conservation biologist with her sights set on saving species in cities and town. And you can tune in to Earth Matters every Sunday on 11 to 11:30.
Now, August 23rd of this year marked the 60-year anniversary of the beginning of the Gurindji Walk-Off in Kalkarindji, also known as Wave Hill Station. And this year's Freedom Day celebrations were held in Kalkarindji on Sunday, the 23rd of August, where Karma Radio's Orlando Rabuncha sat down with his grandfather, George Edwards, a Gurindji elder and chairperson of the Gurindji Corporation, who was just a child when his family joined the walk-off. And we're going to play a conversation or a snippet of that conversation, which was broadcast on the National Indigenous Radio Service, or NIRS.
And then we'll be joined by Dr. Gina Becker, who's the clinical supervisor at the Kasten Centre of Human Rights Clinic, on the advocacy by Monash University's Kasten's Human Rights Clinic and Inuk Melbourne Community Legal Centre, and on behalf of thousands of Melbourne's public housing tenants, which has successfully resulted in an official UN communication with the Australian government regarding concerns about the human rights impacts of the public housing tower redevelopment plan and the human rights impacts and abuses of that. Now, Dr. Gina led the submission and supported the students at the centre in their work and submission, which has also resulted in a formal response from the Australian government.
Earlier this week, Environment Centre Northern Territory campaigner Sarah Wilson joined 3CR's Tuesday Breakfast to unpack the logistics of fracking, how it's actually done and its environmental impacts. Since 2018, state and federal governments have subsidised NT gas companies over $400 million in taxpayer dollars, but financial analysis indicates that the gas industry in the NT is not commercially viable. Today, in our interview this morning, we keep the spotlight on fracking by speaking with fellow ECNT campaigner Dan Broon, who helps us understand the economic myths and legends that underpin NT fracking plans and the link with Country Liberal Party's dubious AI data centre scheme.
Sounds mysterious and nefarious. And finally, we are joined, last week we weren't able to have them on, but this week by AI Safety Symposium's crew members Jules and Opal for a conversation about the importance of developing mass critical literacy about artificial intelligence in an era of toxic tech industry boosterism and regulatory ambivalence. So stay tuned on 3CR 855 AM. We will be with you all the way to 8:30 in the morning, and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
Do you like parties?
Yeah.
We can invite all our friends and have soda and pie.
Yeah.
I hope no bad people show up.
lordy-dawdy. We likes to party, we don't cause trouble, we don't bother nobody. We're lordy-dawdy. We likes to party, we don't cause trouble, we don't bother nobody.
The Vibe Consultant is hosting a party. We're raising money to keep 3CR pumping through the airwaves, with performances from The Steppers, LXRP and Supermassive River Band. This is gonna be a rager. And the best part, it's only $5 entry. Make sure you're at the Old Bar on Sunday, the 13th of September, from 3 p.m.
I would like us to think of this meeting as a serious party.
Be there or be square.
Peace out.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 10th of September. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing has called on the Victorian government to suspend its planned demolition of NAHM's public housing towers and described how the demolitions could worsen the housing affordability crisis. The UN investigation found potential breaches of international human rights obligations, including concerns over forced evictions, inadequate consultation, and the relocation of thousands of residents. The relocations would occur while more than 30,000 people are experiencing homelessness and 80,000 people are waiting on lists for public housing in Victoria. The state government's plan to redevelop all 44 public housing towers is also facing a High Court appeal, which is due to be heard in October.
Also in news this week, Amnesty International says three United States and Israeli strikes on densely populated areas of Tehran in March this year, which killed at least 41 civilians, may amount to war crimes. The human rights group said the so-called targets may have been lawful military objectives, but given the known blast radius of the strikes, the extent of damage to nearby homes and businesses was entirely predictable. Human rights advocates are calling for the independent investigation into the attacks.
Also in news this week, 3 in 5 refugee children living in Australia live in households experiencing severe financial hardship, with access to $400 or less a week during their first year in the country, according to a new report. While living standards generally improve over time, about one-third of refugees remain below the poverty line after 10 years. Researchers are calling for stronger settlement, employment, housing and health support, and a reduction in the 4-year waiting period for newly arrived migrants to access social security. And finally in headlines, Indonesia's Mount Anak Krakatau continues to blanket parts of Java and Sumatra with volcanic ash, forcing local families to stay indoors as authorities warn further eruptions are likely. Residents in affected areas say the ash has covered homes and cars, and people in affected communities remain anxious about potential evacuation and tsunami risks and fear respiratory problems, particularly for children and older relatives. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 10th of September, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
For many Chileans, the other September 11 commemorates the 53rd anniversary of the CIA-backed military coup that cowardly overthrew the democratically elected socialist government of Salvador Allende. Thousands were killed, disappeared, tortured, and exiled. We would like to invite you to listen to this special program on September the 12th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. here at 3CR Community Radio. We will feature a bit of a history, some original recording, testimonies from the exile, and a conversation. September the 12th, from 10 to 2 p.m. here at 3CR.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. You're listening to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. Just so you could hear it again. So our very first segment for today is we listen back to Earth Matters 6th of September program, where host Mia interviewed Dr. Kylie Soans, a research fellow based in the University of Melbourne, about her work finding innovative ways to encourage urban biodiversity. Dr. Kylie is a conservation biologist with her sights set on saving species in cities and towns, and you can tune into Earth Matters every Sunday. But take a listen now.
Kylie, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're an incredible advocate for urban natures, which I think is so important given we tend to think of nature as something that exists outside cities and away from people. Would you say that urban conservation is a bit of an underdog when it comes to wildlife protection?
Yeah, definitely. It absolutely started that way. Thankfully, things seem to be changing, but even now, when it comes to thinking about a place that is a great place for nature conservation or somewhere that nature belongs, the city, the suburbs, these are not places that spring to mind for most people, which is a shame because it means that we overlook what can be really important places for nature, for biodiversity to thrive, but also really valuable places that people can engage with and connect with our amazing natural systems.
Mm, absolutely. And I mean, it also means we overlook some incredible projects that are happening in this area. You've been involved in a lot, things like floating wetlands, possum bridges, 3D printed owl homes, some really interesting stuff. Can you share a little bit about a favourite project of yours?
I think the floating wetlands project is still my favourite. This was something that I was really, really grateful to be part of through the city of Melbourne. So they have a really urbanised stretch of river in Melbourne, the Birrarung Yarra. The edges of this river in the CBD are concrete. Sometimes it's a sheer vertical face. There's none of that beautiful sloping naturalness as the earth meets the waterway. It's just a sheer hard drop, which creates a disconnect, right, between the river and the land, which is unnatural. And it's really hard to undo that kind of thing in the city because you can't plant into concrete and you can't shift a lot of the skyscrapers that have been built right up to the city's edge. So the city of Melbourne wanted to try this idea of floating wetlands. If we can create new space for nature by floating it out on the river itself, what kinds of benefits could we achieve? And I was brought on as an ecological advisor on the project. I helped them think about what kinds of species these could cater to and how we would be able to measure how well they worked, and implemented a bit of a monitoring program to evaluate the change before and after. And the result was that we got these five amazing floating gardens of wildlife habitat across three sites in Melbourne. We have had them visited by so many different types of water birds, rakali, and there are fish and eels underneath them, and swans have been nesting on them. And it's just been this really incredible platform for nature in the city that has helped people be like, oh, we could have nice things here. We could have nature right in the heart of the CBD.
Yeah, I mean, they're incredible things. I've happened upon the floating wetlands and they're immediately eye-catching and intriguing to be right in the heart of the CBD and then see these pockets of what you usually associate with being far removed from a city environment. The other thing that I'm really curious about, I suppose I see a parallel in the people, nature, city, nature divides that come up. I see a parallel in the way that people relate to First Nations cultures, having simple stories about First Nations people and communities being far from the city. Have you had opportunities through any of your projects to engage with First Peoples who have connections to urban landscapes, and how's that experience been?
It's really, really important and really, really rewarding. And, you know, this idea of the human nature separation, I'll talk about how like, oh, we need to let go of this idea and I have to catch myself, because that's very much a Western idea. We all don't have that same idea, and First Nations peoples are not founded on this idea of being separate to nature in the same way that Western culture has. Even the process of creating cities, that very colonial process in Australia, it reinforced all of those separations and really, really strictly. So it's great when nature projects in the city actively try to dismantle that. The best ones are always Indigenous-led. Really, really wonderful examples are things like the Bolan Bolan waterholes along the Birrarung Yarra, and recently the Moonee Ponds Creek revitalization project and the cultural trail there. These are incredible acts of storytelling that are co-designed or Indigenous-led with Wurundjeri people. And they're really beautiful places to visit because you can go there and feel that really strong sense of place. It's really nice to see, and it's really recharging to see.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's so important given that something like 90% of the population on the continent lives in urban areas, to just accept that 90% of the population isn't going to be able to have that sense of place and make place together, it just feels so defeatist, doesn't it?
It does. It does. You know, when we forego urban areas, it's like, well, just write that off somewhere that's in the too hard basket. It's a huge, huge proportion of the population that are missing out. And I guess the other thing to think about, coming back to your point about First Nations perspectives, is that these were always cultural places. You know, the reasons that we chose to build cities in the places they are, that's not an accident. That's because they were rich in resources and they had really favourable conditions. And the colonisers that came to Australia weren't the first people to ever notice that, hey, this is a great place for us to gather and meet and live and to make places together. We just kicked people off of those lands. And so reminding ourselves that cities in particular, they all have current cultural connections for First Nations people, even though the concrete is still there. So finding ways to foreground those, to uncover those, is really important.
Yeah, and I know a lot of our listeners would be really resonating with what you're sharing and appreciating hearing your perspective. How radical do you find that you feel in the space? You mentioned that things have changed, and it sounds like they're maybe changing for the good in terms of how much urban natures are valued and recognised. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you've seen? Because it's been about 10 years that you've been in the space, correct?
Yes, yeah, about 10 years I've been working in this area. And I remember when I started, we got really riled up, the people in my research group, because there happened to be a government report come out about the environment, or the state of the Australian environment. And there was a line in there that mentioned urban biodiversity, and it was about how cities are not good for biodiversity per se, but you could use some greening to give people shade, like they had services to people. And we were really annoyed by this idea that biodiversity in this city was somehow less than or didn't count. And that has really changed. I see that changed in the way that national policies talk about cities and urban environments. You know, there's a section of them in the State of the Environment report now. It includes research that acknowledges how many threatened species, for example, occur in cities, and how important cities are to biodiversity conservation, not just how having a green park can be kind of fun to look at. It talks a lot more now about how important those cultural connections across all spheres are for people, you know, that placemaking that we were talking about. And there's been this really lovely boon in the kinds of actions that people are taking, whether it's a local council or a local community group, or just an individual putting a nature strip garden out the front of their house. It's becoming more and more normal to act for nature in cities. And that has been a really, really wonderful thing to see, because we're seeing this shift towards it becoming more mainstream.
Yeah, great. I mean, that's really heartening. I assume there's still some gaps in policy. What would you say are kind of the priorities going forward in your view?
I think one of the things that I would love to see more of are designing deliberately to invite people into nature spaces in the cities. And so this is a way of, you know, not just having a conservation area that people can't enjoy, and not just having a really bland green park that lacks biodiversity value, but what are the kinds of things that we can do to invite people to see nature in the city as nature that can restore and sustain them, that they don't have to travel 2 hours to get to the nearest national park just to get that breath out feeling that you get when you're surrounded by greenery. And I think there's a lot of really great collaboration to be had between environmental psychology and landscape architecture and ecology to make these kinds of spaces, to design them. But I think that's a really important way that we need to go, because in traditional ecology and conservation, there's still an element of, we can make a self-sustaining ecosystem, it's there, and then it just looks after itself. We know that that's not really true. Australian landscapes have been managed and cared for tens of thousands of years. So the idea that you could create a little pocket of nature in the city and it just be fine on its own as long as nobody touches it is, yeah, it's kind of doesn't make sense once you start to think about it. So inviting people to notice and connect with nature, and then providing them ways to actively care for and curate that nature, I think are going to be really important if we want it to become something that is valued in everyone's day-to-day life.
For those who aren't in positions to be making decisions and initiating projects like that, the everyday listener to this show, for example, do you have any initial tips or recommendations about how they can increase their, I guess, urban nature literacy, how they can give that attention and care to the ecosystems around them?
Yeah, the very first thing that I would suggest people do is to really, really look closely, even at a space that you think must not have anything, especially at a space that you would assume there's nothing there. Whether it's, you know, some derelict patch next to the traffic lights or behind an industrial estate, or just a little gap, you know, beside the footpath that you walk past every day, make a point to stop and just watch, even for 5 or 10 minutes, and notice what shares that space. Because I think we make a lot of assumptions about nature in cities. And one of the biggest ones is that there isn't much there and that they're only using these, you know, beautiful, cared for green spaces. But there's a lot going on in the spaces in between. And if we can understand that better, and appreciate how all the magnificent tiny lives that are sharing this world with us function and respond to these spaces, we'll be better equipped to make decisions to care for them. Once you notice things and notice how they're living alongside you, it's surprisingly easy to see ways that you can help, whether it's by providing a bird bath or a water source on a hot day, or, you know, putting up some trees or shrubs that provide shade, or putting, you know, a really jolly little flower in a pot that provides a pollinator stepping stone. All of these tiny acts I know can feel futile in the face of an entire city, but there are millions of us living in cities. And if we're all doing one of these tiny acts of defiant hope, then we can slowly fill that in a really lovely way.
Yeah, amazing. Tiny acts of defiant hope. I love that phrase. Well, I'm very grateful to you for coming on the show. I do have one last question, which I guess I want to give a special shout out to my favorite urban nature experience and ask you about yours. But I love going to visit the penguin colony in St. Kilda. I only found out about them when I was about 24, and I was kind of outraged that I hadn't been told earlier, especially as a kid. These penguins, they, by my understanding, they moved in when a breakwater was built in the 1950s for the Olympics to make sailing possible in St. Kilda. And penguins just kind of saw prime real estate and moved in. And I think it's such an interesting example of that, like, complex entanglement of humans and non-humans in these spaces. I'm wondering, what's a special urban place or an ingenious species that inspires wonder for you?
Oh, I love that example so much. There is a small park in Perth in Western Australia, and it's in between the, like, tangled octopus arms of a highway interchange. It's called John Oldham Park, I think. And we were stuck there during COVID, my husband and my then two-year-old son and I. And someone back in the day decided, instead of just letting that be an open lawn, that they were going to transform it into a wetland park with a waterfall. And it feels like you are a million miles away in a tropical paradise, and there's a waterfall flowing, and there's everything has that dappled green tinge because the sunlight can only come through the leaves of all these flowers. And it just is this tiny, beautiful, magic place in a highway interchange in the CBD of Perth. And that's sort of what I'm talking about when I'm like, we could create some really magical places in some really unusual places that people can access every day. But whenever I think of a created space of urban nature, that's one that always springs to mind, because it just was, you take a photo of it and you wouldn't ever imagine that it was in the middle of a city.
Incredible. I'm sure our Western Australian listeners are going to be flocking to that park. I'll make sure to put the details in the notes with this episode. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I really have come to appreciate through this conversation that maybe it's not all bad news that we devalue these urban natures, because one thing that it means is the moments that there's that breaking through, the moments of pausing and noticing and being surprised by what's around us, are all the more powerful because we haven't really been given the eyes to see. We have to work for it. Yeah, so thank you so much for all of your insights. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And that was a replay from Earth Matters from 6th of September, where host Mia interviewed Dr. Kylie Soans, a research fellow based at the University of Melbourne, about her work finding innovative ways to encourage biodiversity. And Dr. Kylie is a conservation biologist with her sights set on saving species in cities and towns. And you can tune in to Earth Matters every Sunday on 3CR from 11 to 11.30.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:25 in the morning. And now we are going to listen to a piece reflecting on the Gurindji walk-off. So on August 23rd this year, it was the 60th anniversary of the beginning of the Gurindji walk-off in Kalkurindji, also known as Wave Hill Station, a move which began the journey to the fight for land rights in Australia on the national scale. And 60 years on, the story of the Wave Hill walk-off continues to be carried by the families, elders, and young people who gather each year to remember it. At this year's Freedom Day celebrations in Kalkurindji on Sunday the 23rd of August, Karma Radio's Orlando Rabuncha sat down with his grandfather George Edwards, a Gurindji elder and chairperson of the Gurindji Corporation, who was just a child when his family joined the walk-off. Later in the piece, we'll hear some reporting from Karma's Brenton Woods and community voices from the Freedom Day celebrations in Kalkurindji. Now, this is a piece from the weekly wrap-up of national stories from the newsroom of the National Indigenous Radio Service, or NIRS, which you can listen to on 3CR every Tuesday at 9:30 p.m. or Thursday at 3 p.m. or online at nirs.org.au.
Yeah, I was only 7 years of age. And I walked from here. It was a hard life. And working for no money. Yes, my mum was working for working at the kitchen. Yeah, washing clothes and ironing clothes for them, you know. Yeah, my father was a horse breaker. They treated them bad, eh? Just working for no money.
In August 1966, families came together for a meeting at Jimbarak Wave Hill Station. It was there they decided enough was enough.
They had a meeting, yeah, yeah.
What on way?
Yep.
They never involved anyone?
No, they never involved anyone. They just had a meeting.
Just all the family together? And
all the family together.
A big meeting?
Yep. Big meeting, one meeting, and that's it. Everybody walk out.
Vincent Lingari and Dingna start that meeting. Yeah?
Yep, he was there. No, they just said we had enough. You know, enough is enough, Vincent said. Everybody start walking. Yeah, yeah, I was a part of walk up. And when we went to Cody Creek, that seen that water there, eh? Cody Creek. Yeah, that had no water. Yeah, and all the ladies start digging for water. They found the soggy chip, the water just come up. So we had lunch there. Everybody just keep walking. They was feeling, they was thinking, you know, all the white men would come and shoot them, you know. That's what they was thinking.
George was only 7 years old at that time, but those memories have stayed with him.
Everybody pulled up there and Vincent would start talking there, you know. This is the land belong to Gurindji, he said. He pointed out that's where we're going to live. That's where we're going to find this promised land, he said. Everybody got excited. we got a hand back. Our family was happy.
They're all full of an happy.
How does it feel? I am a proud Gurindji woman. I am proud what we have achieved, our old people have achieved. Our elders made me who I am today. A strong Gurindji woman, a leader in the community. We wouldn't have indigenous organizations without their leadership, without what they've done. And I think being who you are, standing firm, you get to the stage where you win. You win some, you lose some, but we won this one. And we want to keep it alive with our children. We tell our children it's not only about sports, all that. It's about what has happened. Why do we celebrate Freedom Day?
At Freedom Day, elders are making sure that the next generation hear those stories too.
Well, this creek was springing. Mm. But that one's still springing.
Springing, like what that means?
Water.
Oh, water.
That lady is here.
Like encouraging us for stand up for ourselves.
I feel really good, happy, proud for my family, all of them. Culture, carrying the
courage and resilience, and proud to be proud who they are, you know, and where they came from. Mm. But also to listen and learn about our culture and our heritage.
For the young mob growing up here, country is at the heart of those stories.
Feel great to be here. Feel like home is home to us. It's our land. Grow up in here. It's a part of our land.
We'll never forget where we walked off and where our land. We came as one from all different tribes, came in one.
Maybe they might have a look at the videos or, you know, maybe tell stories, you know.
Yeah. Carry that feeling.
Yeah. Mm. This is where I live. This is where I grew up. This is my birthplace.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was a beautiful collection of reflections marking the 60th anniversary of the beginning of the Gurindji walk-off in Kalkarindji, also known as Wave Hill Station. And you heard the voices there of Kama Radio's Orlando Rubuncha speaking with his grandfather, George Edwards, who is a Gurindji elder and chairperson of the Gurindji Corporation, who was just a child when his family joined the walk-off. And later on, you heard some reporting from Kama's Brenton Woods and community voices from Freedom Day celebrations in Kalkarindji. Now, remember, you can catch the weekly wrap of National Indigenous Radio Services Newsroom on 3CR every Tuesday at 9:30 p.m. or Thursday at 3 p.m. Or you can find it online at nirs.org.au.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. If you're just joining us, we started off the show playing a segment from Earth Matters' 6th of September program, where host Mia interviewed Dr. Kylie Soanes, who's a research fellow based at Melbourne University, about her work finding innovative ways to encourage urban biodiversity. And we just listened to a beautiful wrap-up by the National Indigenous Radio Service on the 60th anniversary of the beginning of the Gurindji Walk-Off in Kalkarindji. And now we are going to listen to a quick tune. This one is an oldie but a goodie. It's Koori Rose by Roger Knox.
This lonely heart keeps reminding me of you. This hurt inside keep telling me it's over, but I still love you, Koori Rose. In the evening we stroll down by the river, and as the golden moon shines brightly up above, there we'd watch the rippling water as the river softly flows. I'd whisper words of love to Koori Rose. But now she's gone, it seems my world has ended. Without her, the stars no longer glow. Though they say we should part, she took part of my heart. And only God knows how I miss my Koori Rose. In the evening we'd stroll down by the river, as the golden moon shines brightly up above. There we'd watch the rippling water as the river softly flows. I'd whisper words of love to Koori Rose. Up above, there we'd watch the rippling water as the river softly flows.
Chukuri Rose. Just remember, I still love you.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised longing, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories, from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is ours.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast. It is 7:41 in the morning, and you just heard Curry Rose by Roger Knox. And now we are going to our next interview for the day.
Thanks so much. Now we'll be joined by Dr. Gina Becker, who's the clinical supervisor at Monash's Caston Centre Human Rights Clinic. And they helped lead the Caston Centre and the students in their submission alongside Inner Melbourne Community Legal and on behalf of thousands of Melbourne public housing tower tenants, and has successfully resulted in an official UN communication with the Australian government regarding concerns about the human rights impacts of the public housing redevelopment plan. Thanks so much for joining us here today, Dr. Gina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your work and the Caston Centre, particularly around the human rights issues with public housing redevelopment plan and the work with the UN?
Yeah, I'd happily do so. So in 2023, the Victorian government announced the destruction of 44 public housing towers across Melbourne. And that meant effectively that 10,000 people, around 10,000 people, were going to be relocated. And importantly, the residents weren't consulted before this announcement was made. Since then, much of the public discussion has focused on the domestic legal and policy issues around the redevelopment. This has included court proceedings, a parliamentary inquiry, and now an inquiry by the Victorian Ombudsman. So those issues are obviously very important, but an equally important aspect of the debate concerns Australia's international human rights obligations in relation to, in particular, the right to adequate housing. So it was in that context that the Caston Centre Human Rights Clinic partnered with Inner Melbourne Community Legal in order to prepare an urgent submission on behalf of these affected residents. So the concerns raised in that submission attracted, as you've noted, the attention of the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing, Mr. Koldo Kastler. So it's important to note that Special Rapporteurs are independent experts. These independent experts receive thousands of complaints, allegations, and submissions from all around the world, and they don't intervene in relation to every single matter that's brought to their attention. In this case, however, the Special Rapporteur considered the issues sufficiently serious to actually formally engage with the Australian government. So Mr. Kastler wrote to the government raising concerns about the redevelopment program and raising concerns around Australia's international human rights obligations with respect to the right to adequate housing.
Yeah,
the Australian government, yeah.
I was wondering if, speaking on the submission, could you talk us through some of the most important aspects of the submission to Mr. Koldo Kastler, who is the UN Special Rapporteur?
Yeah, so our submission was sort of 70 pages in length, so I'll try to be very brief.
Yep.
One of the central concerns that we raised was the lack of meaningful consultation. The second was the issue with respect to transparency. So there was very limited public information explaining why demolition had been chosen over other alternatives, such as refurbishment or staged redevelopment. Our submission also highlighted the impact on vulnerable communities. So many residents in these towers are older people, people with disabilities, children, First Nations residents, refugee and migrant communities. And we also placed the redevelopment in the context of Victoria's sort of broader housing crisis. We have very long wait lists for public housing, and there is increasing housing insecurity. So we argued that the redevelopment should only proceed with genuine consultation, transparency, careful consideration of alternatives, and strong protections for affected residents.
Yeah, these are such important aspects of the human rights challenges that come with the housing redevelopment, but it really is like a genuine displacement of people and having to liaise, I think, with the UN and the Australian government, and then also partner with the Inner Melbourne Community Legal and Caston Centre, which it does more human rights international work. I'm wondering what that partnership was like, because, you're focusing a lot on the international response and our obligations as signatories to, different things. But, I'm wondering how you balanced, the international international side of the submission.
Yeah, so I think by working closely with Inner Melbourne Community Legal, that's been really at the forefront of championing the rights of the residents of these towers. By working closely with them, we were able to ensure that our submission reflected the lived experiences of those residents, whilst also sort of drawing on rigorous academic legal research. So being based at a university, the Caston Centre Human Rights Clinic allowed us to sort of explore those international advocacy pathways, including engaging with the UN, and to frame the issue not only as a local housing matter, but also a human rights issue with much broader significance.
Yeah, thank you so much for outlining that. It's such a important collaborative effort on behalf of so many people. And I know that as a clinical supervisor, you led a lot of the students at the centre. I was curious, what do you think about the Caston Centre as, the university legal clinic? How did it have, I guess, an advantage in the advocacy campaign? Not necessarily uniquely, but for yourself.
Yeah, I think the greatest strength I see that we were able to bring to the table was our ability to combine academic expertise along with the Inner Melbourne Community Legal's legal advocacy, and then our expertise in international human rights law. So we were able to sort of bring that to the table.
Yeah, and specifically for supporting your students, what was some of the work that the students of the centre was really doing throughout the process? Like, I presume, legal academic support, but international or consultations and report writing. I'm just curious about what the centre was up to.
Yeah, so the Caston Centre Human Rights Clinic runs a clinic once a year where we have a small number of students working on projects, usually in collaboration with local NGOs. So these are NGOs that don't necessarily have the capacity to engage in in-depth research. And so we provide that resource to them. And in this case, the students were really instrumental in shaping the submissions. So I have to give a shout out to the four students who were involved in this project for their absolute tireless work. And for the excellent work that they did on this project.
Yeah, wow. Hearing that it was four students is blowing my mind a little bit, because, reading the submission and the amount of work that has gone into that, I would expect, presume a team of 20 people had done that. So to hear that it was so small and so considered and, huge, huge effort. To
Absolutely.
Supervise that as well.
Yeah, no, it was really a privilege to be able to be involved in this project.
Yeah, wonderful. And I wanted to know, going back to Mr. Koldo Kassler, what was his response to the submission and the recommendations?
So Mr. Kassler expressed serious concern about the decision to actually demolish these towers. He emphasized that any sort of redevelopment of the scale has to comply with international human rights standards, and that includes the residents' rights to information, to participation, to consultation, and also to transparency. So one of his strongest criticisms related to the lack of meaningful consultation. He also questioned whether the relocation arrangements actually adequately protected residents' rights, particularly where people were going to be moved away from established support networks, healthcare services, schools, and employment opportunities. He also questioned whether demolishing such a large number of public housing homes during a housing crisis could actually worsen existing problems. So he drew attention to the fact that Victoria already has tens of thousands of people on public housing waiting lists and that there are significant levels of homelessness. And he warned that reducing public housing stock without immediate replacement could be a backward step rather than progress in fulfilling the right to adequate housing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we covered it a lot on our program, but it is not just moving a house. It is moving entire communities of schools and workplaces and entire networks that have been there for decades. And it really is so astonishing that is moving forward. I was wondering, obviously the Australian government has formally responded to this. I was wondering, what were your thoughts on the response?
So I think there are a couple of really encouraging points with respect to the Australian government's response. I think, first of all, they began by emphasising that Australia takes its international human rights obligations seriously and also that those obligations apply across all levels of government, including Victoria. So they argued really that the redevelopment of public housing towers is necessary, that it'll increase the supply of social and affordable housing. But I think it's really important to keep in mind that social housing is a broad category, that it includes both public housing and community housing. So the debate isn't just about the number of homes, it's also about the type of housing that's being created.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and whether that's really a shift away from publicly owned and managed housing towards community housing models, which offer different levels of security and affordability for tenants.
Yeah, is there anything that you felt in the Australian government's response that you felt it could have been outlined more or more specific or focused on?
Yeah, I think there are a number of issues, but I think I'll draw out one in particular, and that's the issue around consultation. So both our submission as well as the special rapporteur's concerns that were raised with respect to the Australian government focused on the fact that residents weren't meaningfully consulted before the demolition decision was announced. And so the government basically pointed to consultation and engagement that took place after the decision had already been made. They also pointed to an assessment that had been released sort of a full year after the announcement was made in order to justify the demolition of the towers. So I don't think that they sufficiently engaged with that particular concern that was raised by the special rapporteur.
Yeah, thank you so much for outlining that. It's been quite a lack of due process while people are sitting in the inquiry and people are getting eviction notices and being moved out of their homes. It's so important. I think, we spoke so much about it in terms of policy and local legal work and the impacts on tenants and organising. But, the international obligations are so important to remember. And I was wondering, where to from here and how can we follow the Kasten Centre's work and why is this campaign so urgent? You've spoken a little bit about that, but just to finalise.
Yeah, so we're watching two developments very closely, the ongoing court proceedings and then the continued engagement with the United Nations. I think the issue is about more than just these 44 towers. It's about what the right to adequate housing means in practice. It's about how governments engage with affected communities and how major redevelopment projects can be undertaken in a way that respects human rights. And I think the issue is urgent because relocations and demolitions are already occurring. And once these communities are dispersed and homes are demolished, those impacts are pretty much impossible to reverse. I think for anyone who's interested in following our work, I would encourage you to visit our website and to follow our social media channels.
Yeah, thank you so much. We will have all of that information in our show notes, but thank you so much, Dr. Gina, for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And that was Dr. Gina Becker, who's a clinical supervisor at the Kasten Center of Human Rights Clinic, who led the submission and supported only 4 students at the center in their submission to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing in partnership with the Inner Melbourne Community Legal about the redevelopment plan of public housing towers.
And I just wanted to add something there, a clarification. Eviction notices haven't been issued yet, but we are, you know, watching the situation develop. And it does appear that, you know, people are getting multiple offers to relocate, but there seems to be a shift in the speed at which this is occurring across the tranches. So it seems like with the towers that have been announced in tranche 3, which includes those older persons' high rises that were announced at the start of the year, the government is trying to get things moving a bit more quickly. So definitely all eyes on the High Court hearing, which will be held on the 7th of October this year in Canberra. And the High Court of Australia is going to be hearing Inner Melbourne Community Legal's appeal against the public housing towers demolition. IMCL is going to continue to argue residents should have been consulted with before a decision was made. And you can follow updates about the High Court case at InnerMelbCL on Instagram, and also head to the Victorian Ombudsman's website to look at how their investigation is developing too. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:57 in the morning.
Have you heard about 3CR's national programs? Coming at you on community radio stations around Australia, produced in the studios of 3CR Melbourne.
Services will be cut, jobs may well be lost, and workers' entitlements will be undermined.
Their basic human rights are as important as everyone else.
Over 200 million years, individual species have evolved. I mean, birds were once dinosaurs.
Anything nasty online seems to be targeted against women.
Muckety is a bad deal, but muckety is absolutely not a done deal.
You're listening to Women on the Line.
Welcome again to Lost in Science.
And welcome to another edition of The Radioactive Show.
You've been listening to Earth Matters on the Community Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to Accent of Women.
Anarchist World This Week.
You are listening to Let the Bands Play.
Tune in to Stick Together, worker stories and union news. Grassroots Voices broadcast weekly on the Community Radio Network.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855am. So, earlier this week, Environment Centre Northern Territory campaigner Sarah Wilson joined 3CR's Tuesday Breakfast show to unpack the current state of fracking in the NT, some of its logistics, how it's actually done, and its environmental impacts. Since 2018, state and federal governments have subsidised NT gas companies over $400 million in taxpayer dollars. But financial analysis indicates that the gas industry in the NT is not commercially viable. And next, we keep the spotlight on fracking by speaking with fellow ECNT campaigner Dan Broon, who will help us to understand a bit more about the economic myths and legends that underpin NT fracking plans and the link with Country Liberal Party's dubious AI data centre scheme. Dan, we are so happy to have you on Thursday Breakfast. Welcome.
G'day, Leila. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I thought we could get started with some context. Could you tell us a bit more about the political and economic background conditions that led to this push for commercial scale fracking in the NT?
Yeah, sure. We've come from a place where there was a full moratorium in place on fracking in the territory. And that moratorium was withdrawn a number of years ago when an inquiry took place to look into how fracking could occur and what the dangers are, what the benefits are, et cetera, et cetera. That was called the Pepper Inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that Pepper Inquiry had a whole bunch of recommendations and things like that, but if all 135 of them were implemented, then fracking was potentially viable. Now, those recommendations haven't been implemented in full, but the CLP, which came in a landslide at the last election, has just powered on and said, let's put the pedal to the metal and go hard on fracking. And they've backed Big Gas, and they aren't looking back. So the political aspect of it is we've got a majority CLP government, and they're hell-bent on fracking. Economically, of course, is a different story. So, you know, the good news is they've got a pilot well. First gas has flowed out of a place called Shenandoah South. Now, that's just what we call an appraisal well or a pilot well. So it's not producing a commercially viable amount of gas. It's just enough to feed up the pipeline to Darwin to provide some gas for our energy grid up here.
Right.
But it's nowhere near enough for any level of commercial viability for fracking. And for that to happen, the companies need to expand massively, and they need to have a huge injection of infrastructure cash put into building pipelines and other related infrastructure.
Yeah.
Which is a long way down the track, because the business case just simply isn't there.
Right. So on that topic, I mean, you just mentioned that what's happening now is small-scale production that's mainly just production for a local market. What is the environmental impact of transitioning from the current pilot scale to full-scale commercial fracking?
Oh, well, it's akin to a drop of oil in Darwin Harbour as opposed to an oil tanker losing its load. It's right now there is really a trickle of gas coming out of a dozen or out of only a couple pilot wells, and there are only a dozen or so of these pilot wells sort of exploring the possibility around the territory. Now, they want to put 6,000 wells across the Beetaloo Basin, and you know, these like all mining operations and extractive industry operations, they're prone to failures. So there can be failures in the well itself, which can cause toxic chemicals to leak into the underground aquifers. And the aquifers in the territory are massive, and they're all interconnected, and the science is still being done on how interconnected they are, but we know that those underground aquifers that these 6,000 wells would need to go through all feed into our beautiful river systems and our thermal springs and affect our drinking water and the water for livestock and the water for everything. And water really is life, and to put our water supplies at risk is incredibly irresponsible. And so that's a huge environmental risk. And the other environmental risk, of course, is at the surface level, because when they frack, they pump, they pull the wastewater out if they possibly can, and they store it on the surface. Up here we have something called the wet season, and it rains a lot, and that waste can be inundated, and the entire landscape can become inundated, and there's a danger of polluting the surface water, and then that of course feeds through the entire landscape, and there's any number of problems that can occur with that.
Yeah, it sounds like it will cause serious permanent damage to what is also sacred land. You know, we have to remember that although this land sustains us all, it is first and foremost Aboriginal land, and it always will be. And yeah, it seems like fracking is one of the worst things humans can do to the earth. But there's something new escalating environmental damage across the world, and that is AI data centres. Dan, why has the Northern Territory state government given a fracking company 185 hectares to build a 2-gigawatt data centre? And importantly, how does a data centre use natural gas?
Oh, great question. So they've gifted this land just outside of Darwin in what's known as the rural area, in an area adjacent to a beautiful place called Berry Springs. Berry Springs is really popular with locals and tourists alike as a thermal spring where people can go swimming, but it's also a very sacred place for the Aboriginal people of the territory. Now, that land has been gifted to Beetaloo Energy, which is a fracking company, and they've proposed a 2-gigawatt data centre there. I can't answer why they've given that land away like that, but effectively that's what's happened. Now, this 2-gigawatt data centre uses or would use 6 times the amount of power as the entire Northern Territory. So let that sink in, 6 times the amount of power as the entire territory for one data centre. Now,
wow.
That amount of power requires enormous generating power. There is not enough generating power currently in the territory for that, so they would need to build their own gas-fired power station. So a 2-gigawatt gas-fired power station requires a hell of a lot of gas, and basically it allows Beetaloo Energy, who is one of the companies who want to frack the Beetaloo Basin, to find a local use for their gas. So effectively, because you might remember I mentioned they need to build pipelines and all of this sort of stuff to make the gas commercially viable, this would give them something to a way to use the gas locally while those pipelines were being constructed.
Right, so it seems like they're kind of justifying one form of environmental destruction with another form of environmental destruction. But they do have some justifications for this project, and one of them is that it will increase jobs. Dan, could you tell me how the CLP has framed and calculated the number of jobs supposedly created by their latest fracking and data centre proposal?
I can talk a bit about the fracking jobs. They've come out with a statement that fracking the Beetaloo would create 13,000 jobs by 2040.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Climate Integrity have done some work on that, and they've sort of busted down how they've come up with that figure. They've used an economic assessment from 2017. And this was part of this assessment was done by a consultancy as part of that Pepper inquiry I mentioned. So apart from it being a 9-year-old report, that headline figure of 13,000 figures is not a jobs count. It's a count of job years, it's not actual jobs. So, and it's also done in a best case scenario for them, if you like, and does not look at a moderate probability or anything like that. So Climate Integrity has looked at that modelling and the actual positions as opposed to the job years, and the annual number of jobs. The report says that the Beetaloo development could create under even the very low probability scenarios, only 524 jobs. Under moderate probability, it's 82 jobs a year. So, so that 13,000 is jobs per year, or job years. So that's one job per year over the life of the project. So it's all just rubbery figures used to create headlines and does not bear any reality.
Yeah, those are really unsound figures and quite a manipulative way to communicate that. And it's also safe to say that those figures, which are not good when you break them down, are not even linked to the current economic reality of the area. Now, it feels like we're up against a lot, you know, AI data centers, commercial fracking, US investment, politics. What would you like to see in response to this? And what are some ways that community, like the everyday person that really wants to see the state and broader Australian government be held account, what can they do to get involved?
Great question. Well, the good news is the people of Darwin and Australia won't stand for this sort of bastardisation of our landscape. And we've started our own campaign at the moment. You can go to banfracking.au, and we've started a fence sign blitz in Darwin, where we've put up over 600 banned fracking protect the top end signs around Darwin. If you jump on that website, you can learn heaps and heaps about all of the intricate details of what fracking can do and some of the things you can do. There's a petition there to sign. There's also a petition against the pipeline and the infrastructure that they need to build. But the best thing everyone can do is get informed, really read what's planned for the territory and you know, jump on the ECNT mailing list, really pay attention to those emails when they pop into your inbox, and act when we ask you to act. There's a bunch of intervention points that will pop up over the next little while. You know, those petitions are things you can sign right now, but there will be things such as when the development of application for the pipeline is put in, we need to make sure we act, because that pipeline to the East Coast that they want to build, a $6 billion pipeline, that has to be stopped, because that's the thing that could enable gas to be pumped out of the Beetaloo, and we've got to make sure that that thing never gets built. As an aside, the Territory government wants taxpayers to pay for that pipeline too. They've put in a formal request for the federal government to foot the bill for a $6 billion pipeline for big gas companies to profit off. So people need to be really aware of this is what's going on, and they need to jump on the opportunities as they pop up to push back against these schemes that they're coming up with.
We will include all of the details for what the resources you mentioned, Dan, in our show notes. Thank you so much for joining us today and helping us keep a focus on this really important topic that's going to really affect all of us across this land. Yeah, thank you for joining us.
No worries. Thanks heaps, Leila.
Bye. You just heard from Dan Brune, ECNT campaigner, who helped us understand the economic myths and legends that underpin NT fracking plans, and a bit more about the Country Liberal Party's dubious AI data center scheme that they're using to justify their commitment to fracking, which is not good for people and not good for land. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:15 in the morning and we are now joined by Jules and Opal, who are some of the crew members of AI Safety Symposiums. And they're joining us for a conversation about the importance of developing mass critical literacy about artificial intelligence in an era of toxic tech industry boosterism and regulatory ambivalence. Now, over the past couple of weeks, we've been playing some of the Read Out Loud series based on a booklet about artificial intelligence, which was produced in 2025 by Forrest Gremlin, Poopyhead, and Robot Gnome. And we'll have the link to that in our show notes. But really encourage people to have a read because it is a really accessible guide to unpacking what AI is and why it's important to, I guess, build our critical sensibilities about it. But thank you both for joining me.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks.
Yeah. I guess I wanted to ask first up about the importance of radical popular education about artificial intelligence, because it is something that is being sort of digitally force-fed to all of us. It's, AI capabilities are being integrated into all of the software that we use on a day-to-day basis, whether it's social media, whether it's in the workplace. So bringing it back to basics, why is it important for people to develop an understanding of what AI is and why it is being pushed in this way?
Yeah, really good question. I think like the really important reason, in my opinion, of why we need to really be thinking about this is to be informed. Like, this stuff is affecting the community. And so if it affects our communities, we really need to understand how it affects our communities. And then we can make a decision on like, okay, as a community, this is what we're okay with. This is what we're not okay with. But if we don't have that basic information, then we can't even make an informed choice. So I think like that's the first step, is understanding as much as we can about these systems, about where they're coming from, who's pushing them and why.
Yeah, I feel like it just brings out the lack of consent in the whole context for us.
Yeah. I mean, something that I think about quite often is the fact that, you know, training these models, like large language models, for example, you know, relies on so much extraction of human-produced information in a way that is very, you know, very opaque to most folks. And I think a lot of conversations in media come up about, you know, copyright issues and that kind of thing. But the way that these models are trained extracts data from so many different facets of our life. And I'm wondering if you could maybe unpack some of those concerns about where the information is coming from that, artificial intelligence programs are then drawing from to combine and synthesize.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like all of the data that is on the internet, like if it goes up on the internet, it's been likely gone through an AI model at this stage. Every post, every moment that you pause and look at an image on Instagram, yeah, how quickly you skip through your ads on YouTube, all of that stuff gets accounted. And then you can add in probably all the context of every surveillance camera. Just if it's digital, I'd say very likely it's been run through AI at this stage, if not very soon.
I think it's definitely like worth people understanding that every time you're on an app by one of these major corporations, and that can be anything from, like you said, any social media app, when you install that and you tick a box saying, I consent, you know, to use this app, you've given your digital consent for them to use this data. Any message you put, any photo you upload, you're giving them consent to use that for their AI models. Anytime you use an AI model, anytime you interact with ChatGPT or Anthropic's Claude models, you are feeding that data back into the system and helping it kind of like develop information for the future. So yeah, any interaction that is to do with any mass Silicon Valley digital product, you're most likely helping it.
Yeah, I mean, it is, it's concerning how vague this is. And also, you know, a couple of things came up there. It's like these platforms, especially major social media companies, but also, you know, Amazon Web Services, Google and Microsoft, who have effectively monopolized the, you know, private communications market as well, have access to so much information and also are so deeply integrated into our lives that it's really hard to actually opt out if you want to be able to communicate with anyone, right? Like it's the, you know, alternative platforms that are, you know, safe, where your data is, you know, retained, you know, by you, you still have authority and control over how your data is accessed, that are, you know, end to end encrypted without being able to have like backdoor access, are not operating at scale. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, what are the, you know, implications here about knowing where we're at, given that everybody's lives are so entangled in these systems already?
Yeah, I mean, this is the situation we're in, right? Where they've created this platform and encouraged people to like, this is the way we interact, this is the way we socialize now. And we've kind of been given that as the norm now, so that we are kind of trapped in that system. I think the one benefit maybe we can look at this is like, you know, there are people that have, you know, for years harked back of like, oh, I wish I could get back to my like local community through a face-to-face conversations. This could be like one element where that kind of is encouragement, like, I guess, like encouraging people to get back to a little bit more like face-to-face, on-the-ground community communication. But certainly we are left with little options when it comes to online. They've kind of created this ecosystem now.
Mm. We've done it before, you know. We've been in that context where, I don't know, my parents, my grandparents, like, I mean, even me, like, as an early teenager, I was just, like, didn't have any of this stuff. And, you know, I think it's going to be really tricky for young generations in particular to kind of, like, recontextualize all this stuff, but we got to keep remembering what, like, this was the case.
Yeah, I think like so much of our interpersonal communication now is by default digitally mediated, and there is this process of unlearning, I think, that people will have to go through to be able to figure out like, how do I personally decide how I engage with these platforms, but also like how I relearn how to communicate face to face. Because I think it is, it's become, I guess, like at least in the West, very, like, very much a cultural norm to just by default engage in digital communication.
Yeah.
It's going to take time too, you know. It's just, you don't want to have that, like, at the moment we've got that like weird awkward moment where there's someone like standing in between the two of us having a conversation, which is just like, I don't want this random person like doing that. So, you know, it's just going to take time to just remember how to like push them to the side and actually approach the people in real life, in real context. And those skills, you know, I feel like a lot of kids who, you know, teenagers, late teenagers who went through COVID and just did a lot of that digital stuff. Yeah, we got to like really care for them and help them communicate and help them figure out how to socialize as well.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It feels like such a, like, speaks to a much broader societal problem about like how we communicate with each other and socialize and engage in things like, you know, political socialization outside of these platforms. But I did also want to, you know, talk about a parallel concern, which is some of the material issues that are associated with artificial intelligence systems and, you know, the rise of the data center industry, because these are also, you know, not only created by companies that are complicit in genocide and the military-industrial complex, but also like quite violent and extractive supply chains. So I was wondering if you could speak to that as well.
Yeah, this is definitely a big concern and we need to really think about that. I think we have a very big blind spot when it comes to like how these things that we deal with and interact with in our every day is like, where do they come from? Where do these products come from? What's the supply chain? Which countries are being, you know, quite, you know, openly utilized by these multinational corporations in a really, fairly oppressive ways. So I think it really forces us to ask these questions more. And like, if there's any silver lining in analyzing this stuff, is it does start to like help to like join the dots of like, okay, this product actually comes from a lot of other, I guess, resources. And where do those resources come from? What environmental, places are being destroyed to get them, and what local communities are like being, you know, forced to extract their local communities just so someone across the other side of the world has this item.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it took people long enough to get on board with understanding, you know, the sort of multiple violences involved in just-in-time production for things like the garment industry. And I think maybe there's something of like a psychological disconnect when it comes to looking at digital products that have these physical violent processes built into them just because it's not an artifact you can hold in your hand.
No, I think that's like intentionally, like especially the use of the cloud, like, you know, this terminology that digital corporations use, oh, the cloud, it just feels like this ephemeral thing. But that's a data center. That cloud is actually silicon chips and copper and lead and all these other things that are mined from like places that exist in the world, in the real world. So yeah, this is not a cloud. These things are very solid built items that are highly manufactured and resource intensive. So yeah, definitely like pushing back on that cloud myth is really important.
Mm. Like the internet lives in data center. Like your data center is just stacks of servers, right? Like, and stacks of servers are made of physical things. They exist in places. They extract resources to operate. And yeah, there is something for me in the physical digital disconnect that is maybe part of the explanation for why we haven't seen as much outrage as I can imagine we should be.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, we carry this material around in our pockets, in our bags, and it comes with us everywhere as well. So I feel like we're also really close to the material element of it, but because we're so close and dependent on it, it's like we have to abstract it as well. Like, we can't relate too hard to it, or we are, and yeah.
No, that is a really good point. I'm thinking about, now, this is like very much theory brain, but I'm thinking about Althusser and like the like fake relationship to your real condition type thing. Like that is such a good point where, you know, I think we've been talking about, including on this show, and there've been a lot of conversations about the impact of the critical minerals industry and, you know, the like genocidal violence in Congo, for example, that, you know, sustains the battery industry, and yet all of our phones rely on precisely the minerals that are being mined there. So I was just, you know, this is a massive conversation, but just in view of moving towards wrapping up, like I'm wondering if there's anything you want to leave listeners with in terms of resources they can access or practices they can put into their daily lives to just embed a bit more of a critical sensibility about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'd start with like really having a look at the relationships you have with your technology, and yeah, putting that under the microscope and just being like, oh, do I actually need a phone? I don't know. It maybe sounds crazy for folks, but you know, it is actually possible. Believe it or not, I did 6 months of it one time. It was awesome. It's fucking hard though, and pun my. But yeah, it's just like, we got to keep like practicing, and every time we look at these relationships honestly and unpack them and decide whether this is actually worth our time.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think like we touched on it, I think the element of like talking to each other and getting in touch with community. I think we live in a very like fast, especially in these countries, fast food culture in terms of not only like how we interact with the world, but also like solutions to problems. And sometimes these solutions might take a little bit of time to figure out. And I think the first starting point in this, talking to each other, getting a deep understanding of each other's communities, where each other's coming from. Once we're all informed of where we sit with all this, then start to think about solutions together collectively.
Yeah, that is a beautiful place to leave it, because I think you know, at a point in time specifically where you look something up on a search engine and the first thing is the AI prompt trying to synthesize something, maybe taking a step back and thinking about how we problem solve collectively as, you know, meat sacks is the way to go. So thank you so, so much, Jules and Opal, for your time this morning.
Thank you.
No worries.
And that was a conversation with some of the AI Safety Symposium's crew members about the importance of developing mass critical literacy about AI in an era of toxic tech industry boosterism and regulatory ambivalence. That's about all we've got time for on today's program. So thank you so much for joining us. We heard from Earth Matters. We talked about the 60th anniversary of the Gurindji walk-off. We heard as well about the human rights case going on in the public housing towers. And we also talked a bit about fracking in the Northern Territory and its relationship to the data center industry. We will catch you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.